On Monday in New York City, I will be forced to sit fully gagged. I'm not allowed to talk. Can you believe it? They want to take away my constitutional right to talk. I have a crooked judge. This has never happened before, by the way. You do know that, right?
Former President Donald Trump at a campaign rally in Pennsylvania on Saturday. He's right about that last part. Today, in a Manhattan courtroom, he became the first U.S. president ever to face a criminal trial. He's been charged with falsifying documents and business records to cover up hush money he paid to Stormy Daniels during the 2016 campaign. She's the adult film star he allegedly slept with a decade earlier. It's one of four criminal cases against Trump and probably the only one that will be wrapped up by the November election. We're going to talk about this now with Press Play's Legal Eagle, Loyola Law School Professor Jessica Levinson. Hello.
Hi, Madeline.
It is a stormy Monday. I couldn't resist. Okay, so before we talk about how this trial might play out, remind us exactly what Trump is accused of.
Yes. So we are talking about hush money payments, but those, in fact, are legal. So the question here is really how we get to a criminal courtroom at all. And as you mentioned, we're talking about actually three different payments that Michael Cohen either made or orchestrated to ensure that people didn't tell their stories about Trump having an affair with somebody in the case of Stormy Daniels, or Playboy playmate Karen McDougal, or an extramarital affair in the case of a Trump Tower doorman who said that he had a story about that. So in all the cases, money goes from either American Media, which owns the National Enquirer, to Karen McDougal and the doorman, or from Michael Cohen directly to Stormy Daniels. And the question here is about how Trump paid Michael Cohen back, and the fact that he listed those payments as legal expenses. And what the prosecution is arguing here is those weren't legal expenses. You were actually just paying Michael Cohen back for those hush money payments, and you did so in a way that violates New York state criminal law.
All right. New York state criminal law. But he also may pull in, Alvin Bragg, the DA, may pull in some federal charges, right? We don't know exactly, but something to do with the election, with election charges.
This is the big question, and it's absolutely something I will be watching once the trial actually gets underway. Of course, we're going to have at least a few days of jury selection that just began today. And so falsification of business records under New York state law is typically a misdemeanor. Now, the way you can bump that up to a felony is to show that Trump had the intent, and proving intent is going to be a big deal here, that he had the intent to commit or conceal another crime. And so one of the big legal questions, and frankly, I think legal hurdles for the prosecution, will be, what is that other crime that you claim that Trump actually was trying to commit or conceal? And I think the easiest route probably for Alvin Bragg and his team is to try and say that these payments should actually be viewed as campaign contributions. And $130,000 is obviously way over the contribution amount, which is $2,700, and was not disclosed on any FEC forms. It will surprise nobody to know. And so essentially he'll say, you made these payments in order to try and get elected, and it was in furtherance of your campaign as a presidential candidate, and it should be viewed as a contribution and not a legal one.
A contribution to himself, I guess.
Initially a contribution from Cohen. And it will be, I mean, I'll say the fact that it took me a few moments to explain it, the fact that we had an up and back follow-up about what exactly is the contribution, all of that shows that the prosecution is going to have to do a very good job of drawing a straight line for the jury to explain why this isn't just about bookkeeping, why it's actually should be viewed as another version of an election subversion case. But it's not going to be easy because there's a lot of different laws involved here.
Right. And then, as you said, Bragg has to prove intent. And so Trump, as far as I understand, is going to say, look, all I wanted to do is make sure my wife didn't find out, right? Like, he's not going to say that this had anything to do with the campaign.
Well, Exactly. And I think, first off, he'll say, it wasn't even me. There's some reporting to indicate that he'll say, well, actually, these business records, the ones that you claim are false, I wasn't even the one who made those records. And then he's going to say, well, if I was, basically, I thought that these were legal expenses. And so I had no intent to commit another crime, let alone this crime of falsification of business record. And as we've been talking about for years now, whether or not the former president could be criminally liable, it really so often comes down to a question of intent, because this is a case that happened before he was ever the president, before he'll argue he really understood federal campaign finance laws. And this is a big threshold for the prosecution to prove that he didn't just know about the payments, but he knew that there was a problem with the payments and that they were made in order to try and commit or conceal another crime, which, again, we've been talking about the other crime as federal campaign finance law. They could point to different crimes, but I think that's the most likely one.
Does Trump have to explain what he was spending the money on if he does indeed, or, you know, admit to spending the money in the first place? There, it seems to me that there would be a real risk there, because he's denying he ever had a sexual encounter with Stormy Daniels. So how can he explain away this money?
Well, I think what he's saying is that his part of the transaction, Trump to Cohen, that was for legal fees. And
just straight up legal fees, not anything to do with this. Okay.
I think that will be the first argument. Now, there will be a couple of different, my guess is, a couple of different options that the jurors are given. And again, just looking for one juror to buy the defense's story here. But the other part of that, which I think you're exactly right to point to, is Trump would say, okay, even if this was hush money, you know, and there was a conversation that Michael Cohen will testify to about Trump apparently understanding what the payments were made for, that was just about ensuring that other people didn't find out about the affair at some other time, but it had really nothing to do with the election. Now, all of the timing indicates that this had everything to do with the election. So that will be a difficult argument for Trump.
Right. So this is around the, this is around the October time period before the election. Okay, so Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to federal campaign finance violations based on these payments. He is one of the witnesses. Is he a helpful witness or not for the prosecution?
I think he's both. I think he's key, and I think you don't want Michael Cohen to be your key witness. And there are just no two ways about that. He is the person who can testify to much of what is outside of the documents. And he is the person who can say that Trump understood exactly what these payments were about and why they were being made, when they were being made, and that this had everything to do with trying to make sure that in the wake of the Access Hollywood tape and in the weeks preceding the election, that nobody heard about these stories. But you have Michael Cohen as he comes, which is as a convicted felon, as somebody who just, I think a few weeks ago, a federal judge said might have engaged in perjury. So he really is a double-edged sword here. And the key for the prosecution will have to be proving what is his point of trying to lie, that he's not going to get leniency in any sentence. And would you really lie in this case just because you're so angry at Trump?
Okay. Meanwhile, Trump is possibly facing a gag order in this case. Well, he is facing a gag order, but he may be facing a fine for violating that gag order, I should say, for social media comments he made over the weekend. So how does that complicate the case?
Well, I think actually what the judge would say is it protects the case. It makes sure that justice can be served and that the witnesses and the prosecutors and the judge and their families will not have to live under fear or threats. I think for Trump, it gives him an enormous talking point. And we heard that at the very beginning of the segment where he said, I've been gagged. My First Amendment rights have been violated, which is not true, but it's a great political talking point.
All right, jury selection beginning today. More than 500 people apparently will be called. How long does this take, jury selection in this case?
At least a few days. So we're seeing, as we're having this conversation, we're seeing how quickly the judge is going to move this along. But I think the first group of 96 just recently entered the courtroom. And there are obviously two different types of challenges, peremptory and for cause. And we will see, some judges can do it very quickly. But first, I mean, let's repeat it. Let's end where we began, which is the first criminal trial against a former president. Jury selection is going to take some time. We could be talking about jury selection a week from now for our next segment.
Okay. Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School, our regular legal here most Mondays. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Coming up, how Israel might respond after this weekend's attack by Iran and how that attack may free up money for Ukraine. We'll talk with a reporter who covers both Israel and Ukraine next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. World leaders are urging Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu not to retaliate against Iran. The U.S., Britain, and France all urging restraint. Israel says it will respond in a time and manner of its choosing. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is being pressured by his far-right cabinet members to respond soon and aggressively. On Saturday, more than 300 Iranian missiles and drones aimed at Israel were largely intercepted. Most of the weapons were destroyed before they even reached Israeli airspace. A catastrophic situation was prevented. However, the event marks the first time Iran has launched a direct assault on Israel. And that sets up a complicated new dynamic in the Middle East. Joining me now from Tel Aviv to talk about this is Yaroslav Trofimov. He's the chief foreign affairs correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, where he is covering Israel as well as the war in Ukraine. And he has a new book out called Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. So we're going to talk about Israel and we're going to talk about Ukraine and Russia and Iran and all of it right now with Yaroslav. Welcome.
Great to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you right now. Okay, so let's begin with Israel. You're in Tel Aviv. Is life back to normal there?
Yeah, everything's absolutely normal. I think the only disruption is that quite a few foreign airlines have canceled the flights for the remainder of the month. So lots of Israelis are stranded on vacation or unable to go on vacation. But other than that, there's no sign of anything untoward happening.
Okay, but it was not like that over the weekend with hundreds of missiles and drone attacks. And how was it that they were so easily intercepted and there was so little damage?
Well, this was really a result of Israel working together with the United States and with America's Arab partners in countries like Jordan that allowed the airspace to be used, the intelligence to be gathered, and allowed the U.S. to operate in their airspace intercepting some of these drones and missiles, but also a result of Israel's own Arrow air defense system, very sophisticated system, that managed to shoot down the most dangerous of the weapons that Iran had launched, the ballistic missiles. The ballistic missiles are notoriously hard to intercept, and only a few of them, of more than 100 of those that were fired at Israeli targets, actually got through. That's a remarkable rate if you look at the interception rates in Ukraine, where the vast majority of ballistic missiles do hit their targets.
Okay, so what does this say about Iran's military capabilities and the fact that they telegraphed this, or at least everybody knew that this was going to happen, and even to maybe the exact hour when this would occur? So what does that tell you?
Well, it tells us, first of all, that Iran's capabilities are not as serious and threatening as Iran wanted the world to believe, on one hand. On the other hand, it's also really a testament to the high effectiveness of the Israeli air defenses. Those are very sophisticated, and they performed what many military analysts would describe as almost a miracle, because the size of this barrage was huge. It's, if you remember, the first day of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the sort of the shock and awe campaign, It was only about 200 missiles. So you had more missiles and drones flying into Israel on Saturday night.
Wow. And so was it largely Israel's defense system, or could they have not done it without the U.S. and Jordan and other Western allies?
I mean, they could have not done it with such a high rate of success. Israel says it intercepted about 99% of the drones, cruise, and ballistic missiles heading its way. So several more would have gotten through. I wouldn't know what damage they would have caused.
So go back in time a little bit. How did we get to this point where Iran is attacking Israel with such ferocity? We know that earlier this month, Israel assassinated a top Iranian military figure in Damascus in Syria. So talk about that and how this set up what happened over the weekend.
So, you know, even though Iran was, you know, the leading power in the region, leading the campaign against Israel ever since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, this is really the first time you have a direct attack from Iran on Israeli soil. And the countdown probably began on October 7th with the Hamas attack in southern Israel out of the Gaza Strip. Hamas obviously is backed and helped by Iran. And in the time after that, Iran really tried to stay out of a bigger regional war. And its most powerful regional proxy, the Hezbollah militia in Lebanon, has been very restrained because Iran still needs it as an insurance policy in case Israel goes after Iran's nuclear program and strategic installations. So that's one of the reasons why it was so choreographed. So Israel has been stepping up a campaign of assassinating or targeting Iranian military advisors and officials in Syria. But that attack obviously crossed Iran's red lines because it was an attack on a building adjacent to its diplomatic mission, or part of the diplomatic mission, depending who you ask. And three generals of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps were killed and several other officials. So Iranian hardliners felt like they had to respond, but again, they felt like they had to respond without triggering an all-out war. So that's why they telegraphed this attack and also targeted military installations. You know, particularly they tried to hit Israel's biggest airbase that has the F-35 fighter jets. Mm-hmm.
So after Saturday's attack, does Iran gain anything from this, or does it kind of look humiliated?
Well, there are two ways of looking at it. On one hand, the Iranian attack failed in inflicting any serious damage on Israel. But on the other hand, a precedent has been established of Israeli soil being directly targeted from Iran. The head of the Revolutionary Guard has said that now there is a new equation. You know, every time Iranian interests are damaged in the region, there will be a direct response. And that's why Israel feels under pressure to do respond, despite all these requests for caution that are coming from Washington and other capitals. Israeli leaders are still deliberating how to respond, and probably there will be some sort of response. But again, Israel does not want to have this lead to a full-scale regional war, and trying to have sort of this limited tit-for-tat going on without triggering thousands of more missiles and rockets in Israeli cities.
What is the state of U.S. and Western ability to penetrate Iran in terms of finding out what it's going to do ahead of time? Like, what's its espionage capabilities?
Well, I mean, Israel certainly has a very strong network in Iran, and has shown it by delivering some intelligence to the U.S., but also by assassinating some of Iran's top nuclear scientists, creating cyber attacks, another sabotage. But at the end of the day, in a system like Iran, it's the supreme leader, Khamenei, who will make the ultimate call. And that's why it's so hard to really evaluate the decision-making process, just as in Russia, because who knows what is going on inside Putin's mind when it comes to strategic choices.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Yaroslav Trofimov. He is chief foreign affairs correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. Let's talk about Ukraine now. And you mentioned that Russia, at the beginning of the war 2 years ago, fired a similar barrage of weapons at Ukraine. Right now, we're 2 years into it. We have $60 billion in U.S. military aid being held up by House Republicans. Give us a lay of the land now. What's happening in the war now?
Well, first of all, you know, the Russian missile and drone attacks are going on. It's almost you know, every day or every few days, there is quite a large drone and missile attack at Ukrainian cities, energy infrastructure, talking about dozens, sometimes hundreds of projectiles in one night. And the interception rate is much lower, obviously, because this funding has been stalled in the U.S. Congress. So it's just, it has to ration, you know, which cities, which targets to protect. And as the Ukrainians watched this extraordinary display of solidarity with Israel, where the U.S., the British, the French, even the Jordanian air forces were all in the air shooting down Iranian missiles and drones, they, you know, there's a lot of questioning in Ukraine now. Well, what about us? Why couldn't they help us shoot Russian missiles, even from across the border? Why are we left to fend for ourselves? And so this is all coming at the time when on the front lines, the situation is deteriorating again because Ukraine is facing a shortage of ammunition, because of the shortfall in U.S. funding, and because Russia has rebuilt its military and is pressing ahead. And Russia's war aims haven't changed, really. You know, just to annihilate Ukraine as a state, it's still pursuing the same objective.
And so what do you think, though, that this attack over the weekend might do to unlock that funding? Do you think that, you know, from your reporting, that Republicans in Congress might be more willing now to unlock a joint package of funding for Israel and Ukraine?
Well, let's see. Let's see what will happen. I mean, there's certainly promising noises being made, but there were also promises in the past that never kind of came to fruition. Certainly, there is new urgency in Congress because this attack on Israel was very expensive, but will it actually translate into action? Let's see. I mean, so far there has been no movement on either Israel or Ukraine since October.
And you are Ukrainian and in touch with people there on the ground, and you obviously spent a lot of time there reporting for your book recently. What is the feeling in Ukraine these days? There was so much optimism and, you know, I don't know if I want to say exuberance, but a feeling that the country would fight off this, you know, major former superpower. So what is the feeling now, 2 years in, as Russia is, you know, it's got better and more supplies than Ukraine does right now, and a city fell in February. And I'm just wondering what the general feeling there amongst Ukrainians is these days.
Well, I mean, on one hand, it's true that there is a lot of sort of feeling of being betrayed by the U.S. You know, the American president had come to Kyiv and said, we will stand with you for as long as it takes. And now, you know, the U.S. military aid has been essentially cut off for several months now, which is the reason why this city of Avdiivka has fallen. But if you look at the big picture, the miracle is still there. This small country, certainly not a military power, has managed to prevent the Russians from taking it over. That stopped the Russians from destroying the Ukrainian statehood and then drove them back, and is still holding the line, more or less. So that little army that could is still fighting, despite being cut off from American aid, and still holding the Russians at bay and inflicting massive casualties. The Russians probably lost more than 20,000 soldiers just to take this town of Avdiivka, which had a pre-war population of 30,000 souls.
And who is fighting? Is it still, you know, regular people who were working as accountants or teachers or lawyers before the war? Who's on the front lines now?
Well, it's increasingly so, because most of the professional Ukrainian army, just as most of the professional Russian army that existed 2 years ago, most of these people have been killed or injured in fighting. And so both countries are recruiting more and more, mobilizing more and more civilians and throwing them into this really bloody fighting, which hundreds are dying every day. And Ukraine has issues with manpower, with personnel for the military. It just lowered the recruitment age from 27 to 25. And it has people who are trying to flee the country, not to fight. But still, despite all these challenges, it is still more or less holding the line. How long will it do it depends greatly also on what sort of assistance will be forthcoming, whether it will get the ammo and the weapons in the month ahead.
And how much time do they have before things really get bad?
It depends on what happens. Someone in Kyiv might not necessarily want to go to the front and die for a town in Donbass, But the motivation would be different if Russia were to break through and if the very independence of Ukraine were to be endangered again. So basically, it sort of all depends on the internal cohesion of both societies, Russian and Ukrainian. But in this war of attrition, it's mostly about how long either of these two societies will hold out and which one will crack first. And obviously, you know, the amount of American and other Western aid for Ukraine will be a factor in this.
Right. What is the connection, do you think, between the Iranian attack on Israel and the Russian attack on Ukraine?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have now seen in the last 2 years a real alliance emerge between the rogue states, Iran, North Korea, and Russia. Russia is highly dependent on North Korean ballistic missiles, North Korean ammunition, and Iranian drones, the very same drones that were used against Israel. You know, they were all tested on the Ukrainian cities for 2 years. And Russia is giving political and military cover now to Iran and to North Korea. So you have this real new axis of evil, if you will, emerging. And the goal of all these powers is, and of China, which is not militarily engaged with them directly. It's not a direct member of the military alliance, but certainly is backing them economically and politically, is to overthrow the U.S.-led international order that has benefited the U.S. Since World War II, and to create a new system worldwide. I mean, that is the long-term ambition.
So do you think that Russia, which has long thought of Ukraine as its own and didn't really take its independence in 1991 seriously, do you think Russia would stop if it was able to capture Ukraine and stop there? Or, you know, some are saying that this is just the beginning of a march towards other European countries.
Yeah, I think there is a growing fear in Europe, including Western Europe, that Russia will not stop. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, just a few weeks ago said that the war in Ukraine is existential for France and for the European Union. You know, I was just recently in Estonia, in the Baltic states, and in Poland, and you do hear this talk there that, you know, war is coming, war is going to come here in 2, 3, maybe 5 years. People are talking about what to do. Should they invest in their homes? Should they buy properties in Spain? Should they buy guns? You really have this sense in Europe now, as the British defense secretary recently said, that we now enter the pre-war period. And so that's why the Europeans are waking up and investing a lot more in the military production and in helping Ukraine, because they know that as long as Russia is bogged down in Ukraine, it will not have the energy to threaten the European Union and NATO.
Well, I want to thank you so much for all of your expertise on multiple fronts today. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you. I wish I could be more optimistic.
Yeah, it's sad and dark times in the world these days. Yaroslav Trofimov, Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. Tomorrow on Press Play, we'll have a conversation with actress Janelle James. She plays the incompetent principal on the TV show Abbott Elementary. Coming up on this program today, construction begins on an overpass over the 101 meant for animals to safely cross from one part of the Santa Monica Mountains to another.
The world's largest wildlife crossing will celebrate a monumental milestone.
Come 11 o'clock tonight.
The 101 freeway will be shut down overnight for the next several weeks.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The commute from Agoura Hills to Los Angeles just got longer for humans. Southbound 101 in Agoura Hills will be shut down Monday through Friday from 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. beginning tonight. The closure is expected to last for weeks as Caltrans continues building what's described as the world's largest wildlife bridge. The annoyance for drivers will make life easier for animals. The crossing will provide safe passage from the Santa Monica Mountains to the Santa Susana mountain range for species that need to roam for food and for breeding. Joining us now is Beth Pratt Bergstrom, California Director for the National Wildlife Federation. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Okay, well, this is an exciting moment for the animals. It's been years in the making. And describe why this was necessary.
Yeah, it is an exciting, you know, some of us have, I've been working on this project for 13 years, others for longer, and construction broke ground 2 years ago on Earth Day, but this is a pretty big milestone. It's you're going to start seeing the first horizontal structures, so it'll look like the bridge it will become. But this is so necessary, and we appreciate, I think one news outlet dubbed it Crittergeddon. We're calling it closure for cougars. Aww. Yeah, it's for a good cause. If we do not build this wildlife crossing, it is almost certain that mountain lions will not have a future in the Santa Monica Mountains. But it's also biologically important for all wildlife there. The Santa Monica Mountains is one of 36 biodiversity hotspots in the world. And wildlife is challenged with especially that 101 freeway just being such a significant barrier.
Right. And cougars have died crossing and other animals as well. The most famous cougar, P-22, somehow made it across. I think not only the 101, but also the 405. How did he do that?
It's astounding. Most male mountain lions in the Santa Monica Mountains, as the National Park Service long-term study has shown, don't make it past the age of two, right? So many urban challenges. A lot of them do get hit on the roads. We've had a few hit near the wildlife crossing site. But P-22, our beloved P-22, who we still miss, was one of the few cougars to make it, you know, males to make it out. But he was the only one we know of that crossed both the 101 and the 405. And as somebody who has retraced his route on foot, God, almost two dozen times now, I don't know how I make it alive. Never mind him. Yeah.
Did you really try to cross those freeways?
No, I have not tried to cross the freeways afoot. I do go over the bridge, but even that is pretty hairy for a human. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the wildlife crossing, humans won't be allowed on it, right?
No, this will actually be just for wildlife. And, you know, it's going to be a native habitat on top. It's pretty astounding. This just isn't a bridge to, you know, for animals to walk across. You'll have, you know, foxes maybe raising a family on it, western fence lizards. Although the mountain lions get the most press because everybody loves cats, this is being designed from everything from monarch butterflies to mountain lions. It really is a whole scale solution to reconnecting that Santa Monica Mountains ecosystem to the rest of the world.
It's so beautiful. And so, as you say, it took many, many years to come to fruition. And I guess it's all, most of it's funded privately. Is that right?
It's about a 50-50 split. The public money that was used is not taking away from bridge repair or hospitals. It is money that has to be spent on the environment for the most part, like, you know, bond measures and stuff. So and then the other half is, yes, private funding really stepped up here. Of course, most notably, Wallace Annenberg and the Annenberg Foundation have donated $26 million. But we had 6,000 donors from all over the world, you know, including Leonardo DiCaprio, Barbara Streisand, the John Logan Foundation. I mean, I could go down the list. Everybody came together to make this a reality. And boy, is it now. It's pretty cool to see this being built.
Yeah. Well, part of the reason it's not just to save the existing animals' lives, but to hopefully have some more breeding, right? Because P-22 is an example. He was a lonely bachelor when he crossed those freeways after he crossed the, he didn't have anyone to hang out with.
No girlfriend. I think, you know, he got to Griffith Park and was like, okay, no other mountain lions here, males to challenge me. There's plenty of food. Okay, bachelorhood ain't so bad because I ain't going over those freeways again. But yeah, you know, the mountain lions being killed and wildlife being killed by the road is obviously a serious thing we want to solve, but we actually don't get as much roadkill as you'd think there, because the freeway is such a barrier. The animals get to it and they are like, I'm turning around. And what that causes is an actually more pervasive problem, which is genetic isolation. And the mountain lions south of the 101 are inbreeding themselves all out of existence. They can't get dates outside their family. So they're breeding with their daughters and granddaughters and great-granddaughters. So much so, inbreeding causes all sorts of problems. They're starting to show birth defects, as the National Park Service research shows. And at some point, you know, the alarm bells, they will be sterile from the inbreeding. P22 is the most extreme example of this. Not only, you know, was he not able to get dates outside of his family, he couldn't get any dates. He was cut off from any of his kind. So this is solving, actually a more pervasive problem, which is the genetic isolation.
Okay, so hopefully that will be solved. When will this crossing be finished?
Yeah, originally we were projecting the end of 2025, but these two wet springs record, as you know, really did push it a little bit. So we're now looking into 2026. But in 2026, join us for that, you know, ribbon cutting when the animal highway will be open. And I just love that both people and wildlife will be able to commute at the same times. You know, we do a lot of restoration projects in conservation, but never one on top of one of the busiest freeways in the world. So that's a pretty hopeful project for me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And hopefully we'll talk to you when that happens. Beth Pratt Bergstrom, California Director for the National Wildlife Federation. Have a great day.
Thank you. Yep.
Stay here because we'll have a new music playlist for you. Our DJ Wildflower will be here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Conexión Ancestral, a new track from the LA-based artist Reina Tropical. It's just one of the new songs that KCRW DJ Ro Wildflower Contreras has been vibing with lately, and she joins us now to share some of her new music recommendations. Hello.
Hi there. How's it going, Madeline?
Tell us more about Reina Tropical.
Reina Tropical is a duo. It started off with Sumo Hair. They're based out of Los Angeles, and now it's just Fabi. So it talks about ancestral connection, and being that Reina Tropical lost a member, Sumo Hair, due to an accident here in Los Angeles, there's a lot of connection in like speaking to the ancestors through the music after a person that you really love has left. And I think that's such a part of the human experience, is to connect with our ancestors.
Si las montañas me llaman, encamíname. Vengo de tierra sagrada, la sangre sabe deshidratada. La sierra sin agua y de la punta más alta. Me pregunté por qué.
And what happened? It was just a freak accident?
He was on one of those scooters in downtown LA. Oh. And yeah, it, you know, the LA Times wrote about it. It was pretty sad, you know, and it makes me not want to touch one of those scooters.
For sure. Yeah.
So, and the album's called Malegria, which connects mal in Spanish and alegría, so bad and good. So the happiness and the sadness, which is like the duality of the life experience, right? Mm. And their music is really happy, but the lyrics are really sad a lot of the times. And so that's kind of what we're working with this album and these sonic offerings.
And this track in particular, Conexión Ancestral?
Yeah, and Conexión, the whole album is pretty much a Conexión Ancestral, but the title of it drew me in, and it's just so upbeat, and it feels like summer. And a lot of the record was recorded on the beach. That's a Novena Carmel just interviewed them on MBE, and they note a lot of these like really beautiful the road on what created the album. So I thought it was really special to start us off with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. You also have brought a new song by the group Brain Story, and we'll hear a little bit about the song and then talk about them. The song is called Nobody But You.
Learn to use your voice, it'll do you good. I tap into your
Nobody But You by Brain Story. And this band is from Rialto, California, so the Inland Empire. Tell us more about them.
They are a trio of some of the most special down-to-earth cats that are really digging back in time and also making future music. They work with Leon Michaels from L. Michaels Affair. They're on Big Crown Records. So they're quite special and they're really chill and just good dudes, you know? And so that comes out in the music. I really enjoy being around them and I can't wait for all of the new releases. Sounds Good is going to be released very soon. And it's just so feel good and optimistic, even in the sad songs again.
Okay, that's the group Brain Story. Some other cool dudes you brought with you today, at least in musical form, Chicano Batman. And they are longtime KCRW favorites. We just love them. And they have a new collaboration with the group Say She She. So let's hear a little bit of that. And this is a track called The Way You Say It. The Way You Say It by Chicano Batman featuring Say She She. Tell us about this collaboration.
You know, Madeline, this one was quite strategic. How do you pick five songs? It's so difficult, right? So I was like, I know, let's squeeze in Say She She and Chicano Batman.
Oh, very
and,
good.
You know, I had to do a little...
Two birds.
Yeah, two birds. And Notebook Fantasy is lovely, upbeat, fun. You know, the videos are all wearing silver and they're coordinated, and it takes me back to a time when, you know, like the Supremes were coordinated and like It's just vibey. So, and we love Say She She and we love Chicano Batman.
And yeah, so together we love them.
Yes, that the love is amplified.
All right, that's The Way You Say It by Chicano Batman. Now for a more moody, soulful song. This one's called One Last Dance, and it's by the singer Baby Rose from a collab EP with the band Bad, Bad, Not Good. Another one of your two birds, because it's a collab between Baby Rose and Bad, Bad, Not Good?
I want to say yes and no. I mean, if looking at these five selections, if this was a sandwich, this song would be like the protein, the meat, you know? It's so dense and gorgeous and fulfilling. And it's one of, you need the balance. You can't have all upbeat. You're going to have a low day during your summer or your year. And that's your go-to.
Well, Bad Bad Not Good has been around for a while, but tell us a little bit about who Baby Rose is.
Baby Rose is like ancient, cosmic, new, like she like channels Billie Holiday. And she has like the silky, soft, magical tone that really is grounding. You know, she's she's from DC, but she's got this like Southern belle. She can't go around it. You know, when you sit and you speak to her, you speak to her mother, there's so much grounding and like powerful femininity spewing out of her music.
I love it. Baby Rose and Bad Bad Not Good. The new EP is called Slow Burn. All right. Finally, we have an Australian offering from the Melbourne-based band Hiatus Coyote, also a Kaiser Lee favorite, and this is called Everything's Beautiful. This album, and tell us more about this band and why you like them so much.
They just teamed up with Brain Feeder, and I'm really excited to hear Love Heart Cheat Code. And Brain Feeder is an LA-based record company that Flying Lotus put out, and their collaborations are really fantastic. I'm just excited to hear all the new stuff because they've released two songs, and everything they've released before has been super solid. So Everything's Beautiful, it's a reminder, even though things can be hard, you have to remember the beauty in them. And there's a lesson in that. And it's not easy, you know? And sometimes certain songs remind us that it's okay and you'll be able to find the beauty in it. So I really gravitated towards that song, and it's been on loop, and I can't wait to hear the rest of the album.
When does it come out?
June 2024.
Okay, and time for summer. Yay.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, Everything's Beautiful by Hiatus Coyote. And that's it for us. Everything was beautiful in this conversation. So thank you. Thanks for joining us today and sharing new music with us.
Thank you so much. It was a delight.
KCRLB DJ Ro Wildflower Contreras. You can hear her every Wednesday night at 10 o'clock right here on 89.9 KCRW. She's a wild thing. She's down to earth. She's on my wavelength and she's not her work. Never looking to bother. She's got her own thing down. It's never a problem when she has. You know, you can download or subscribe to our podcast at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts, and you can listen to the show whenever you want. It is free. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you again tomorrow.